It's time for Intersections, where art and science meet, your weekly hour of conversation, where you learn about curious ideas, creative works, and interesting phenomena with your host, Mark Kingsley, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Now, it's time for Intersections, where art and science meet.
I'm Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, where we create a museum without walls so artists, scientists, and the community can create unique interactions and conversations. Today's conversation focuses on a new digital exhibition, Conversations with a Shipwreck. It revolves around the Swedish warship Vasa, which sank in the Stockholm Harbor in 1628 on its maiden voyage. It was found and raised in the 1950s. It is now in its own museum in Stockholm. We have with us two special guests who are instrumental in the founding of this exhibition. Please welcome Joan Wickersham, an author. Hi, Joan.
Hi, Mark. Thank you for having us.
And Adam Davies, a photographer. Hi, Adam.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great. You know, it's exciting to have both of you because you have such this is all about interconnections, and you guys have such a wide, diverse background. So, Joan, if you don't mind, would you just take a few minutes and give us a sense of your background, both as a writer and artist, and art historian?
Yeah, I'm a writer from Cambridge, Massachusetts, or current living in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and I have written fiction and memoir over my career. Wrote a novel when I was quite young, and then I wrote a memoir of my father's suicide, which happened when I was in my early 30s. And I was, you know, obviously a very devastating event, and I was really interested in the what led up to his death and also the impact that suicide has on a family. So I wrote a book called The Suicide Index, which I spent about 10 or 11 years writing. I've also written my next book was a book of fiction called The News from Spain, which is a collection of seven unconventional love stories, each of which is called The News from Spain, but the title means something different in each story. So those were two books about very messy emotional experiences. And that was my background when I first visited Stockholm in 2013 and first saw the Vasa. And I'll talk more about that in a minute, but first I want to hear from Adam.
That's great, Adam.
I'm a photographer who I shoot large format photography. So I use one of the cameras that you may have seen pictures of from the 19th century or early 20th century, where you get underneath a hood and there's a huge camera with bellows and that's on a tripod. And so that's primarily the type of work that I do. And the work previous to working with Joan, the work that I was doing was mainly landscape and architectural photography, and particularly looking at structures, infrastructure in cities, and how that interacted with the nature and the landscape around it. Joan and I met in Provincetown at the Fine Arts Work Center, she mentioned, and she came up to me with this proposal to photograph the ship, and it struck me as something really unusual, really exciting, and that's sort of how it all got started.
That's really, that's interesting how we meet, and I'm going to come back a little bit to the camera itself, because that'll interest, since we're art and science on the science part, but I'm really fascinated how in the world, first of all, did you guys decide to do the ship?
Well, you know, I was in Stockholm in 2013 on a vacation with my husband, Jay, and he had read about the Vasa in National Geographic magazine when he was 6 years old. And it was such a dramatic story. You know, as you mentioned, Mark, the ship had been built to be an absolutely terrifying warship. And it was gigantic and bristling with guns, and it sailed out into the harbor on its maiden voyage, and it sank within minutes. It was so that there were so many miscalculations in the design that the first gust of wind just tipped the ship over and it capsized and sank in front of everybody who came out to watch. And so the ship had been under the harbor for 300 years. And then there was an independent scholar named Anders Franzén, who was searching for the ship in the 1950s, and he found it in 1956. He used homemade grappling tools to explore the bottom of Stockholm Harbor, and he found the ship, and he enlisted the Navy and the King and all of these engineers in Stockholm to do this massive effort to try to raise the ship up from the harbor floor and restore it. And I will tell you later in this conversation about some of the scientific calculations that went into that. But Jay had read this story in National Geographic in 1962 when the lift was completed, the ship had been raised, and he just never forgot these images. So when we were in Stockholm in 2013, he really wanted to go to the Vasa Museum and see the ship. And I was not particularly interested, but I went with him just to keep him company. And when you walk into that museum, it's just, you're kind of stunned by the sight of this ship. It's a very large space. It's very dark. And there is this massive warship just coming at you out of the gloom. And it's just, it was such an emotional experience because it's as if the ship is, it's there, it's physical, it's concrete, and yet it is like the ghost of itself. And the way it's presented is quite ambiguous. You're not sure if you're seeing it before it went out on its first awful voyage or whether you're seeing it on the ocean floor as a shipwreck. It's a kind of a timeless space where there's just this beautiful, mysterious object. And I was just blown away by it. And I started writing pieces almost immediately that were addressing the ship in some way. And I started doing research on the story. I returned to Stockholm many times. And so I was working on this project, a book project, for about 4 or 5 years. And then, as Adam said, we met in Provincetown. We were both teaching. I saw his photographs, which are utterly beautiful and poetic. They struck me almost the way the ship did, that they're both very, very factual, but they're also extremely poetic. And I just suddenly got the idea of inviting him to come to Stockholm to photograph the ship. And incredibly, he said that he would be interested.
Adam, Lloyd Jones just describes that, and I'll put up some of your photos of the ship on our website. But what you're able to capture, and I think it's particularly that particular camera, but your eye also, Joan described that really well. So what made you want to do this project?
Well, Joan's being a little modest in the sense that I think one of the great things about the Fine Arts Work Center is that the people who are teaching there present to each other. And so there's a moment where we get to listen and see what other people are working on. And for 2 years running, I'd heard Joan, we'd been given the same week to teach. And so we'd overlapped and I'd seen and heard her read her pieces on this Vasa boat project that she was working on. And there was something about what she was doing there that was very visual, I thought, in terms of how she was using language to describe this object. And I think also when she approached me, I was just at this moment where I was really wanting a new challenge, and I wanted to sort of twist and turn a little bit and do something that was linked to what I had done before, but was entirely new as well. And I mean, the opportunity to go to Stockholm to work in a museum and photograph a ship like this doesn't come around that often. So I just figured it had to jump for it and go for it.
Wow. You know, Joan and Adam, one of the things I think about when I think about this is how beautiful the title is, Joan. Was that something you thought about, the conversations with a shipwreck?
That was something that actually came out of a question that one of my former students asked me. Adam and I did a presentation of this work last summer for the Fine Arts Work Center, a Zoom presentation. And one of the questions that came in in the Q&A from a former student was, how did you come up with the idea of addressing the ship? And one thing that's interesting about putting work out there is, I think for me anyway, when I'm working, I'm not really that aware of what I'm doing. I just have to be working in the dark. And when you start to actually share the work and you start to get responses from people, that's when you really find out what you did. And it hadn't occurred to me before she asked that question that all of these pieces that I've written are in some ways conversing with the ship. So it was a project without a title for a long time. And that title really did come out of that lovely interaction with this person who had listened very carefully to what I was reading that night.
Wow. And then Adam, when you were looking at the ship and you were in there and then, you know, you're under this hood with a very large camera in front of you and you're looking, how do you look before you get under the hood and then try to do that? Or do you move around under the hood? Can you describe a little bit of your process?
Sure. So the view camera on a technical level and a scientific level is a really interesting camera because it's just to talk about the camera for a second, the front and the back of the camera move separately from each other. So the lens moves separately from the back, which means that you can optically tilt and distort the image in camera. So you can make optical distortions rather than doing digital or anything like that. And so you can make perspective change. You can sort of shift the layering of how things lay out in the image. And that's part of what really attracted me to working with this camera. It's a very slow process. So I think the most we ever took in one day was about 4 or 5 photographs in 8 hours worth of work probably. So it's a lot about setting up and establishing the shot and working out the parameters and then working with the available light and working with the framing and getting the camera perfectly positioned. So the hardest part for this project though was the darkness actually. And it's something that I really wanted to bring into the pictures. I wanted these to be very murky and sort of mysterious images. But in order to accomplish that, I asked for the museum to turn off all the lights so that we were using available light, just light coming through the windows basically to light the ship. And I thought that was really effective in terms of taking it out of feeling like an institutional photograph or a photograph from a museum. But the hard part about doing that is, especially in Stockholm, that there was very little light at certain times. And so the exposures themselves often took many minutes, including the photographs of the back of the ship took about 40 to 45 minutes each shot. So once the shot was exposed. So there's a lot of sort of old fashioned sort of technical working out reciprocity and different sorts of things about figuring out how the film responds to light and then figuring out how you should make your exposures. But the process of taking the pictures, because it was so murky and so dark, you never completely knew what you're going to get until after you taken the picture. So that to me, I really like. And that's why I like shooting on film as well, is that there's a delay between taking the picture and actually seeing what you get.
And I would think that that fact you're shooting onto film, right? Mm-hmm. And you're not digitally able to see it. You brought up a point that is really important for people to understand, and that is you don't know what you get until you actually develop it.
Right. And this was like after we go home. So, you know, it was like we left Stockholm before I get the negatives. We did have to go back a second time and do a few makeup shots. But I really do like working that way because it's sort of like maybe like in sports, getting into the zone or something like that, where you have to trust that you know what you're doing. And I've worked with this camera for over 10 years. I know this camera pretty well. And it's you're just completely focused on that moment. You're not getting distracted, or you're not just looking back at the images that you took, but you're just really just focused on getting this one shot and then going from there. So it's a more of a meditative act than a lot of type of photography, I think, just working this way. But what was really cool, and just to throw it back to Joan, is that Joan accompanied me to all these shots. And so one of the things that was really interesting, and because this is a sort of a long process, and if the exposure was 45 minutes, we'd be sitting there talking in the darkness while this camera's exposing. And that was very generative, just hearing what she had to say and what she saw. And then that sparked ideas visually for me and maybe a little bit in writing for her as well.
That's true. There's one piece in the exhibition that I actually wrote during one of those 40-minute exposures. We actually got the museum very kindly let us be in there after hours, and they took us up on the hydraulic lift that the cleaners use to access the back of the stern of the ship. So we were up there looking at the carvings very, very closely. We were inches away from these beautiful carvings that ordinarily nobody would. First of all, nobody would have seen them closely in the ship's first life because they were part of a warship that would have been at sea, so it would have just been a blur. And even in the museum, you can't get that close, but we were lucky enough to be up there because of Adam's photography. And so I actually wrote one of the pieces because I got that unique vantage point all of a sudden. So yes, it was a very, I think each of us found that we were moving into areas that we wouldn't have moved into without the eye of the other person.
Yeah, and Joan, I know you saw his photos and his work early, but you hadn't seen him work, right?
No.
So how was that? Can you describe that experience, seeing Adam at work?
It was fascinating. I didn't know what to expect, and I think the amount of care that went into choosing what to shoot. Adam said the first time he and I went into the museum together, we had a conversation, and he said something really interesting that hadn't really occurred to me, which is that because the ship was a museum object, it was being brilliantly displayed in the museum, but they had really thought about all of the display angles for the ship. And so part of his challenge was to see things that hadn't really been seen, that weren't pre-planned viewpoints of the ship. He was interested in getting around those and getting behind those. And
yeah, in a sense, it was curated by the museum, and they had a viewpoint, right?
Yes, yeah. Exactly. And so he was interested in really finding things that were new, both in the ship, and also we did a lot of exploring of the city of Stockholm together, and we were also interested in new ideas and new places that hadn't really been thought of. You know, in my research, I had found some sites that had to do with the story of the ship. And so Adam and I actually went there to some of these sites together, and that also led to new things. So I think the amount of technical knowledge that went into these shots, you know, I loved what Adam just said about not knowing how it's going to come out, but it's at the same time, there's so much knowledge that goes into choosing what you're going to look at and what you're going to focus on. And so the care and the slowness, I think I loved that. And then the second thing that I really feel that I loved about watching Adam work was the rigor of his judgment, you know, that he wasn't happy with if the light wasn't right, then he didn't try to fudge anything. It was absolutely pristine in the intention. And I really, that's a very inspiring thing, you know, because when you're working on an art project of this kind, a writing project for me, it's very sloshy. You know, you just kind of, there's nothing, when you're writing, what I'm writing here is really poetic meditations on something. So there's no personal sense that I've got it right or I've got it wrong or whatever. And so to be working with someone who was so rigorous, it inspired me when my confidence would flag. I would kind of hold myself to that same standard of rigor, which is really, it's bracing.
That's great. Adam, can I flip it on you? You only heard her work, right? Or heard it read. When you saw her working during that moment that you're describing, Joan, where you were waiting and you were writing something, what'd you think?
When I was actually taking the pictures, you sort of get in your head so far down into it that you don't really recognize what's going on around you. But it's funny. I don't generally like to photograph with other people present as much as possible. And in general, my work doesn't involve photographing people, so photographing objects. So it's, but Joan is, as you can maybe tell, is an incredibly warm and sort of just sort of respectful and a person to be around, and sort of the trust came very quickly for us. And I think, you know, it was very easy to try things out and take risks in front of each other and not be too worried about it. But I think for me, it was the things that she noticed, really. She would point things out that she was interested in that were maybe a little bit more specifically like a specific object, a specific moment, a specific, or providing a background on the history of something that I was looking at that I hadn't, because she'd done so much research on this ship already, that she was sort of leading me through sort of the deeper depths of this project. And those would trigger, you know, an image or some idea that would then want to try out, or I mean, that sense of adventure of we have something, but then we want to expand out. And it's kind of nice working with a piece in a museum, which I hadn't done before, is that everything is sort of contained in the museum, but then because of the history of this boat and the legacy in Stockholm, it had all these little branches and all these paths to follow that took us out of the museum to the dry dock, for example, where it was first taken after it was pulled up out of the water, to the cliffs where it actually sank. That helps us sort of tell the story of the city as well, in a way.
Go ahead, Jen.
The other thing that I was going to say that Adam and I, it took a while to kind of get to on my part, because I think I began with the notion that somehow Adam was going to do visually what I was doing in words. And so it was very hard initially for me to get away from the idea of illustration, that he was going to somehow, if I was writing about a key in the museum, that he should photograph that key. And I didn't want him to do that, but he really didn't want to do that. But I think it was just hard to sort of, for me to break away from that sort of anxious literal idea. But we found that as we started to bounce around together, things would come together in odd ways. For example, in the exhibition, there are two things that are paired. The exhibition is a series of 12 of my pieces paired with 12 of Adam's images. And we've made 12 little videos. Each one is an audio of me reading the piece and then Adam's image kind of coming out of the darkness to look at while you listen to the piece. So one of the particular pairings I'm thinking of in that show is a piece that I wrote. One morning I was waiting outside the museum for it to open, and the only other person waiting there, I was with my husband, the only other person waiting there was a woman, an American woman, who was also waiting to get into the museum. We got into a conversation with her, and it turned out that she and her husband, who is now dead, had visited the museum in 1965 when the ship was still being sprayed with chemicals to try to preserve it when it had been pulled up out of the harbor. So she told us about that earlier visit to the museum, and it was very was a very vivid little poignant encounter. And so I wrote a piece about it, which is in this exhibition. And we paired it with this photograph that Adam took of a diorama inside the museum, a model that shows how they lifted the Vasa from the seabed with lifting pontoons. They would fill the pontoons with water to sink them lower in the harbor. They would run wires under the ship and then pump the water out of the pontoons, which would lift the pontoons in the water, lift the ship a little bit off the bottom. So there's a sort of series of models. So Adam took this wonderful photograph of one of the models, and we paired those two things together. And it just works, because it's not a literal illustration of what I wrote. And it's just, it somehow works in some inexplicable way.
That's wonderful. We've been talking with Joan Wickersham and Adam Davies about a new digital exhibition called Conversations with a Shipwreck, revolving around the Swedish warship Vasa. Please join us for more conversation after our break.
Join us for the University of Indianapolis Faculty Artists Series on Saturday afternoons at 2 o'clock. Host Michael Toulouse brings you his fine commentary as we showcase faculty and visiting artists performing exceptional concerts and recitals from the Crystal DeHaan Fine Arts Center on the University of Indianapolis campus. That's the University of Indianapolis Faculty Artists Series, Saturdays at 2 p.m. on 88.7 WICR.
No alarm clock. No traffic to negotiate. No staff meetings to attend. Sunday is your day, so do yourself a favor. Tune out all that noise and tune in for Sunday Baroque.
Sunday morning from 5 to 9 here on 88.7 WICR.
Hello, Indiana. This is Dr. Laura Merrifield Wilson, host of Positively Politics. I'd like to invite you to join our conversation on the current issues and events in politics with the experts who know them best. Every Saturday morning here on WICR at 11:30, we break down the sometimes negative and often complicated world of politics in a nonpartisan, straightforward, and educationally rooted way. You won't want to miss the discussion on Positively Politics Saturday morning at 11:30 right here on The Diamond.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Kiesling, and today we're having a conversation about a new digital exhibition, Conversations with a Shipwreck, with Joan and Adam. And before the break, Joan, you were talking about what I love to hear, and that is true collaboration. And you guys were talking about the way that Adam didn't want to just illustrate, and you didn't want him to just illustrate, which is often where we put visual artists. Can you guys talk a little more about what it means to really be collaborators? Adam?
Okay. I'll put a little bit on the spot, but I'll take it. It's fun. I think, especially in photography, even more so than maybe other visual arts, photographers typically are thought of as illustrating or documenting works, and there is a whole professional field in which that is important to be done, and there's a lot of great documentary photographers that I really admire. But for me, I've always been interested in thinking about my pictures more in as an artistic process, and for me that means asking questions rather than resolving answers in the pictures. So really trying to open up possibilities and make discoveries in the process of actually making the picture. And just to speak really quickly technically about the camera, the other reason I use film and I use this camera is because of the level of resolution that this image has. So it can be printed almost billboard size and still be really, really sharp, tack sharp. So the amount of information that's contained in these photographs is much higher than you would get on even a top-end digital camera. And that sort of sense of sometimes the camera isn't your eyes, so it can see things that are beyond what you can see even, or make discoveries, is something that intrigues me as an artist. To go back to the point about collaboration, I think that was always a prerequisite to working with Joan, was this sort of understanding that the pictures wouldn't be illustrations, and Joan never really considered it that way either, and definitely didn't want it that way. So it's a matter of, and her writing, I think also, you know, I think we both in this project were struggling with the idea of working with something that is historical, that is scientific, and then also trying to add our own personal subjective voices to it and not disrespect the science or the history, but make it something else, evolve it into something completely different. So I think we were sort of very much on the same page when we were thinking about how we were working in relationship to that.
Yeah, I agree. I thought you said that beautifully, Adam, because I think we did both love the historical and the factual. You know, a lot of what we were looking at were artifacts in in the museum. So we really were, we wanted to respect that. We didn't want to just use it as a kind of excuse to jump off into autobiography. But at the same time, we both felt very stirred by what we were seeing. And we wanted to try to allow the emotional associations that come when you are contemplating a historical object. And when you're particularly something like this, that was also a human tragedy, where a lot of the artifacts in the museum were things that belonged to the people on the ship. And also in the museum, you see the bones. They display actually the skeletons that were found in the ship. When the ship sank, most people got away and escaped because it was right in the harbor. And so people just jumped off and swam or were picked up by other boats. But there were some people that were trapped below decks who died in the wreck. And so that's part of what was discovered when they raised the ship. They found these bones, and the bones are in the museum. And so it's a very, you know, it really makes you think about mortality, and it really makes you think about the helplessness of human beings when a tragedy happens, and really the helplessness of all of us in the life cycle that eventually we're all going to be those bones one day.
Yeah, and that leads us really well, Joan. What I'd like to do is I have a clip, an audio clip of you reading one of the pieces called The Owner of the Skull. If you don't mind, I'm going to play that, and then I'll have you guys react to that.
The Owner of the Skull. I mean you, not the museum or the Swedish government, but you, the man who lived in it, in whom it lived. Whatever stories you had heard of shipwrecks, you didn't hear this one. You knew in the violent suck and torrent that this was final. Maybe you thought of heaven, Christ, whatever you'd been taught. You never thought of a diver. You never thought they'd build another man using your scaffolding. They've given him a face and hair, some freckles, moles. You wouldn't know yourself. His name, they say, is Philip. The quotes marking the place where knowledge leaves off and fiction begins. No one knows your name. More people see him in a day than saw you in your lifetime. He lives in your bones, lays claim to your possessions, your clothes, your knife sheath, and your coins, four of them. He's taken everything you had. He, they say, still had two milk teeth hidden behind permanent teeth in his lower jaw. Those tiny pointed secrets that only your tongue knew and never could have told because they were so much a part of you that you never knew you had them. He had two milk teeth, the label says, meaning Philip, meaning you. The book on my desk is open to the pictures of your skull and Philip, the wrong blue eyes staring from your sockets. Maybe being found, restored, is just a different way of being lost. Come back, I want to say, to my father and my mother. Be who you were and not who I try to make of you.
So, wow, that brings tears to my eyes. And I have the benefit, and we will put on our website a link so that others do. But Adam, I was able to see an image, and I'm not sure what I was exactly seeing, but it was so appropriate. And it faded in and faded out. Can you describe the image for us, Adam, a little bit while Joan was talking?
Sure. It's a pool of water. And what it literally is the pumping station that pumps the water out of the dry dock that's never completely empty. And it's a long exposure. So the water is, there's movement. There's a fish under the water. So there's light catching and streaking the water itself. And then it's sort of almost an industrial structure. But just this idea of sort of depth and sort of the murkiness of her piece in a certain way sort of just seemed to fit. I really enjoyed the juxtaposition, like playing with juxtapositions and playing with things that don't necessarily initially fit, not that these don't fit, I should say that differently, but I enjoy playing with juxtapositions that are sort of more complicated or strange, and this one just we tried out and it just worked, you know, and we sort of came with pieces that we liked and then sort of playing with them and putting them together. And it's sort of the process of doing this digital project really was exciting in that respect as well.
Yeah, and I could only imagine, Joan, that when you add that image the way he had and through his own eyes, he was interpreting some words that you had, and it wasn't illustrating, it was interpreting. And it added so much to the prose that you were saying.
Yeah. I think that I think in a way we're trying to create kind of a psychological space that's both visual and a space of words. Because when I saw the, this particular piece is about one of the skeletons in the museum. They had to assemble the bones, and they've given each of them a kind of a fictional name. And they've also created some computer animations of what the people may have looked like based on the osteology, on the cranial sizes and measurements and all that. So there's actually this skeleton of this sailor who was trapped under under a gun carriage. And then you see this kind of model of what he might have looked like, which in a way is terrific because it helps you imagine a human being, but in another way it's robbing him of whatever real identity he had, because that's not him, that's a fiction. And I think that Adam's photograph captures that sort of ambiguity of what exactly are we looking at. So again, it's not, I think it's a beautiful photograph. And I think in a way that's as close as I can get to explaining why it works. And I think why it really works is that I can't quite explain it. So I think that's what we were almost looking for, is a feeling of rightness. And one of the things that Adam said to me before we made our first trip is I was trying to plan out what we were going to do. And he just said, let's just go to Stockholm and we'll make a bunch of stuff and then we'll see how it fits together. And that's exactly what it was. So I think when you were asking about the collaboration, one of the great joys for me about it has been that it's really intuitive. And I just love that, because any art that you do is really intuitive and it's alone. So to be able to have that kind of intuition going back and forth with another person and have things that don't work, and then both be honest about when it isn't working. And then when you get to something like that particular pairing that does work, we know it and it's lovely.
Yeah, from mine, why it worked for me and was so emotional with the two of you with that was the idea, I captured a soul. Not I wasn't really getting an image of somebody being drowned or an image of a person, but there was a soul that I was mournful for. Imagining being down in that water and your words, and it couldn't have, in my estimation, it couldn't have been done without two art forms. So the words and the image had to be there. And Adam, even though there's movement, it wasn't movement like a video exactly. It's really hard to describe. And again, I'll put these up so that our listeners will have that same experience, but quite incredible. Adam, how did you capture that kind of sense of movement in that?
The movement is actually objects moving underwater, and because it's such a slow exposure, what happens is that it becomes blur. So you get these different sort of light diffractions and they start to create streaks on the water. But I guess just hearing you talk about it, it's sort of almost like time going by is what you're recording. So there's this sense of a progression. It's not movement in terms of objects moving, but more just that a period has elapsed almost in the pictures. You see that with old fashioned photographs as well, where if the skies are incredible or blown out white and everything seems incredibly still, there's no people on the streets. It may have been because it was such a slow exposure that people had actually walked through the picture but never shown up in it. And that sort of thing has always intrigued me about old photography. in particular.
Yeah, me too. And, you know, when you mentioned the idea that of not doing humans very often, I think it was very difficult in that era, if you remember, that people couldn't hold a smile for very long. So many of the images we saw were of people looking kind of sad and dour, because that's a long time for a long exposure to hold a smile without your mouth moving.
Slightly off topic. I've actually been in one of those neck braces that hold you steady for one of those pictures from the 19th century. They're incredibly uncomfortable. So you sort of understand why people can't hold a smile for very long. There are ways of holding them still for a couple minutes for a picture, and it's a painful process. So yeah.
It's unbelievable. Well, just a reminder that the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists, scientists, and members of the community to engage in conversations that explore the intersections between art and science. We encourage you to explore further in conversation with others any of the ideas that we're exploring today in the show, and we'll be right back.
There are everyday actions to help prevent the spread of respiratory diseases. Wash your hands. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Stay home when you are sick. Cover your cough or sneeze. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects with household cleaning spray. For more information, visit cdc.gov/COVID-19. This message brought to you by the National Association of Broadcasters and this station.
Hi, this is Tony Morris. Join me for an hour of some of the best music for guitar on Classical Guitar Alive. Each week we explore a wide variety of music with guitar, and you'll also hear interviews with many of the world's foremost performers and composers. That's each week on Classical Guitar Alive.
Saturday mornings at 5 on WICR The Diamond.
Welcome back. We're having a conversation about a new digital exhibition, Conversations with a Shipwreck. And I'm really curious, both Joan and Adam, I know that when you were asked to do this project, you had a bigger idea in mind than other than this digital exhibition. Can you describe what you had in mind and what you're still planning to do?
Yeah, the digital exhibition actually came about because of COVID, and I'll talk about that in a second, but we had always envisioned this as a book project. I've written a lot more of these pieces. There are about 12 of them in this exhibition, but there are about 60 of them altogether, and Adam has taken a lot more images than appear in this particular digital exhibition. So we're working on that much bigger project, which we had initiated. But as part of that, when we met and decided to go to Stockholm together, we got a grant from the American Scandinavian Foundation to fund that work in Stockholm. And so they asked us, when COVID began, they asked us if we would be interested in creating a digital exhibition for them. And so that was the impetus to do this. So, we hadn't thought about that. We had thought about the book project and also in-person exhibitions with Adam's photographs printed at large size and my words being read, but the digital exhibition really was a result of the limitations imposed by COVID.
Wow. And so, you know, that makes this even more powerful in certain ways, in that people were able to experience it. Do you have, I'll put it on our website, but do you have a location that they can go to if they're listening and they want to see the exhibition?
Sure. The website is conversationswithashipwreck.com. Very simple. All the words together, conversationwithashipwreck.com.
That's awesome. Go ahead, John.
Conversations, plural, with a shipwreck.
Conversations. Yes. And what I love, I've been to that website, and you're fully immersed from the beginning. And, you know, as a museum professional, I love the way you were able to create that same feel. That you're going into something amazing that isn't anything like a website. So I encourage our listeners to go there. Joan, earlier you had promised you were going to tell us a little bit of the whole technology of trying to raise this ship and why it was preserved for 200 years in almost what's amazing to me, almost its original shape. I mean, it had some wear and tear, but wow.
Yeah, I was particularly wanting to say that because I know that one of the focuses of your show is about science, and there's actually the ship sank in a way because of the physics of the design. It was just, it was too wide and it was too shallow. The shallowness was because it was designed to come in close to the shore and terrify people. And so it was really top heavy. And it also had a last minute change in the design of the, they inserted a second row of gun ports too close to the waterline. So when the wind blew, the ship just fell over and sank. But what's really interesting about the preservation of it under the water for 300 years is that ordinarily shipwrecks get eaten by shipworm. And one of the things that the discoverer of the ship, Anders Franzén, understood about the Baltic was that the Baltic has a very low saline content and shipworm can only live in salty water. So he understood that if he could find this shipwreck, it would likely be intact because the shipworms wouldn't have gotten at it the way they got at shipwrecks in other oceans. So one of the pieces that I have included in this exhibition was a real kind of flight of fancy piece that I wrote called Shipworm Teredo Navalis, which is really addressing the shipworm and talking to the shipworm about why it didn't eat the ship.
I love that. Adam, you got, as we said earlier, to go up on a lift and see parts of the ship that really, it's hard for visitors to see when they see the real thing. But what struck me, and I was wondering if it struck you, when you first were going up on the back of that ship and you started to see some of the art, including the words and stuff, did that kind of surprise you on a warship, that it would have been, that would have been on a warship?
Yeah. I confess, I didn't, before doing this project, I didn't know that much about military history, boats in particular. The degree of ornamentation, both on the back of the ship and then also under the front of the ship, where you have your mermaids, your dolphins, but also many other carvings, figures, really sort of blew me away. And as we understand it, they were all painted decorative colors. The colors have all disappeared, so that all you have is this sort of very dark black wood that's left. And I think it looks more powerful because of that. But it is interesting sort of discovering learning how it would have looked at that time. I wonder who would ever see some of these carvings, you know, and they're little idiosyncrasies, you know, that someone has two left arms instead of a left arm and a right arm because they had an extra arm that they carved and they stuck it onto one of these smaller figures. these are things maybe in museums that the people who work at the museums might know these little secrets, but there's very few other people ever have the chance of being able to get up that close to an object and know the little idiosyncrasies about it. And that was really incredible that the Vasa Museum gave us the opportunity to join them and to learn from them in that regard. We felt like we were sort of part of the back, we felt like we were working with the museum a little bit behind the scenes while we were there. And it was really sweet and really incredible of them to do that.
Joan, what struck you that was unusual when you were in the project?
Well, I just want to add a little bit to what Adam said, because in a way my answer to that question builds on what he just said. That experience of going up on the lift and seeing those carvings was so moving because of the integrity of the carvings. You know, when you get close to those statues of knights and warriors, their eyeballs have pupils. Their fingers have knuckles. Their fingers have fingernails. And you just think about these carvers who were probably the same German and Dutch wood carvers who would have been doing church organs all over Europe at that time, because church organs also had these ornate sculptures that no one really ever saw up close. But the carvers were really doing their work for God and for their own integrity as artists. And so to see that up close was just extremely, extremely moving. And then the other thing that I personally find very moving about the Vasa Museum is these small objects, you know, the domestic, the little sewing boxes and the coins and the little game board and the buttons and, you know, things that just remind you of your own domestic life and your own possessions. And I just found that experience of just being very close to these objects was very moving.
I would assume, John, that those objects helped you recreate a story.
Absolutely. I was thinking about both of my parents had died, and I had been, you know, as so many of us do, sorting through their belongings and just thinking about the things that are left when you die, which are just what happens to be around you when the accident happens and you have to go into the nursing home, or the illness strikes and you have to go into the hospital, or whatever it is. And so I think it did bring up a lot of associations for me about that. The other thing I just want to say about the project, and this was something else that I think you can really see in Adam's photographs. When you're working with the Vasa, you're working at a vast scale. The ship itself is huge. I mean, it's a huge, huge ship. It's not a little, it's not a canoe, it's a warship. But there's also this tiny, tiny scale in the museum. One of the things we got to look at was when they raised the ship, they found a barrel in the kitchen, in the galley of the ship, that was filled with fish that would have been served if the voyage had gone on. So all the little bones of those fish were still in that barrel. And so within the Vasa Museum, there was some, I'm not sure what the correct term would be, but it was a ichthyologist, paleontologist, who actually sorted out all of those tiny little bones into categories. So there was a little box of fins, and a little box of spines, and a little box of tails, and all of he had taken apart all of these little herring, which are minuscule, they're the size of eyelashes, and there were these little boxes. So and part of what I loved about working with Adam is I felt that his eye could see these massive things, and then also these minuscule things, both in the same level of detail and both with the same level of honoring those things.
Adam, when you're composing your shot, are you doing that outside of the camera first? Kind of, I mean, the work there. So you're trying to notice all these things and where you want to do that. Is that how that works for you?
Yeah, I've been working with this camera over 10 years and using the same lens pretty much the entire time. So it's just, I've gotten pretty comfortable being able to see how the camera sees, if that makes sense. And a lot of it is framing it in your head and sort of then moving back and forth. But one of the nice things about the view camera, and the reason why you get under that hood, is that you can actually see the picture before you take it on the ground glass on the back. It's upside down. That's the one thing that throws you a little bit. But it's not reversed, it's just upside down. So there's a lot of getting under the hood, taking a look, going back, moving a little to the left, a little to the right. It's sort of this slowly getting towards the image. One thing that I thought was interesting just about what Joan mentioned, for her, I think she really keyed on these little details. And for me, it was more the larger scale of the object itself. And I think that was kind of, I learned from her to look closer at the details, and you know, and for me, it was more about the weight of this object and the size of this object, and maybe because I'm more comfortable photographing larger objects as well. I was always trying to find these spaces, these voids, and sort of trying to imagine what it would feel like to be inside the ship itself, what it would feel like to be next to the ship if you were in a small boat, just feeling that presence and trying to create an image that had that same sort of heaviness in a way.
Yeah, and I think the exhibit that you guys did, but also the one that the museum put together, was genius in that we know from studies with museum visitors that I was very large, you know, like dinosaurs, big things, the boat, or the very tiny, like we do in dioramas and stuff, seem to be appealing. And you've got both of these in your exhibition, your digital exhibition. You've got the big and the little in the same way in your language. Joan, you're doing the same thing. You're zooming us in to a little detail and bringing us back out. I think it's wonderful. So that was my own comment on how beautiful this is and how much I would encourage people to take a look at it. Any last words either one of you have or thoughts that you'd like to talk to our visitors about?
Well, you know, I would sort of build on what you just said, Mark, to say that part of why I think the first visit I ever made to the museum made such a strong impression on me is that I think the museum itself, the Vasa Museum in Stockholm, does an amazing job of telling the story. Because I walked in knowing nothing. I didn't know about the ship. I wasn't interested in ships. I wasn't, you know, and yet I understood. There was a lot more to learn after the first visit. Obviously, I've gone much deeper since, but the museum itself did an extraordinary job of storytelling. And that's one of the things that I think museums can really do is storytelling. You know, it's not about flashing lights and buttons to push and, you know, whatever, but this museum really does a job of telling you the history of the ship, which includes the building of the ship, the disastrous failure of the ship, the salvage of the ship, the restoration of the ship, and then also the environmental challenges that are still going on about preserving the ship for the future, because it's a very fragile place. The museum itself is an ecosystem. It's affected by the humidity and the breath of the guests who come in, the body heat of the guests who come in, and they're constantly having to adjust for that. So there's a little exhibit in the museum about that. And so I felt that the museum itself does an extremely beautiful job of storytelling.
Yeah, and revealing the magic, right, behind the exhibition. Adam, anything that struck you that you'd still like to tell us?
I'm not sure if anything's coming to mind.
Oh, that's fine. That's really good. Well, what's wonderful is that we've been able to talk with both of our guests, Joan Wickersham and Adam Davies. And I want to thank you both for helping us explore this really amazing exhibition about that mysterious, this vessel. I want to know more about the Vasa. It just seems like the idea that it was destroyed and then preserved, and the way it destroyed wasn't in battle. It never made it there. It had its own battle with the elements and the ocean, was incredible. You'll find pictures of this project and of links to other parts of it, as well as links to some of what we've been talking about, where we've got Joan's voice and Adam's work together on the Da Vinci Pursuit website at thedavincipursuit.com. Where we create museums without walls so artists, scientists, and the community can come together to enjoy unique activities and conversations. Until then, I'm Mark Kiesling, reminding you to tune in again next week when we explore more curiosities from the intersections of art and science.
You've been listening to Intersections, where art and science meet, with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman-Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Just a reminder, the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists, scientists, and members of the community to engage in conversation that explore the intersections between art and science. We encourage you to explore further in conversation with others. Any of the ideas explored in today's show at www.thedavincipursuit.com.